Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
Today on the pod, personal emails spur another review of the Greenbelt land swap scandal.
A cap on student visas puts the financial instability of post-secondary education into the spotlight.
And an Ontario cabinet minister is quitting provincial politics to run federally. Our thoughts on why he's making the jump and why others aren't.
And in your column, my column, I'll focus on whether Canada will have enough electric vehicles to meet our target in 2035.
While my column looks at the larger-than-life Rocco Rossi, who after 6 years has stepped down as head of the Ontario Chamber of Commerce. He turned 62 this week, but he insists he's not retiring, he's rewiring.
It's January 30th, 2024, so let's get to it.
JMM, did you have fun at Roma last week?
I did indeed. I had the privilege of moderating the Minister's Forum, where most of the Ontario cabinet gets peppered with questions from elected officials from around the province. And, on my way out of the conference, I bumped into several people who, I've done a few of these now, so it was good to see some familiar faces and some people who had nice things to say about the stuff we do here at TVO.
Well, and you know how I knew we had a lot of listeners there?
How's that?
Because people would constantly come up to me and ask me about, how's JMM doing? And no one started calling you JMM before I did on this podcast. So that's how I knew.
That's true. I've had many nicknames in my past, but JMM really became more common currency since I started doing this podcast.
Indeed. And, actually, I've got to say, I really enjoy going to the Roma events, too. And we did a couple of panels there for the agenda, which we shot and will be shown on a later date. It is really great. And, I always want to remember, because, of course, we spend the preponderance of our time here in Toronto, and I always want to remember that the province of Ontario is so much more than Toronto, and you can get sucked into the Toronto vortex and thinking that if it doesn't happen at Queen's Park, it doesn't really happen. And you go to a Roma conference and you see Roma, Rural Ontario Municipal Association, and you see so many issues that are taking place outside the Greater Toronto Area. And it's just a not that you and I need reminding, because I think you and I spend a lot of time outside of Toronto, but it's just, it's a great thing to remember that there's so much more to Ontario than just the capital city.
Oh, absolutely. As you say, we try reasonably hard to keep our mind outside of the provincial capital and outside of the largest cities, because there's just so many other stories out there that, also deserve attention. And still, despite our best efforts, you go and you spend even just, an afternoon with the folks at Roma and, you hear about problems in this community that are just unlike, what you see anywhere else, or, other perspectives that you just don't necessarily anticipate. I will say one of the things that struck me while I was up there, under the spotlights at the Minister's Forum. This year, more than past years, I did think that a lot of the issues were much more general. It wasn't specifically or exclusively questions that you would only hear about in rural Ontario. Rural representatives were raising issues like healthcare funding. Now, obviously, in rural Ontario, that has a very specific valence. But then you also had elected women asking about whether the government would support legislation to protect female politicians and civil servants subject to harassment. That's not specifically a rural issue, but here were rural representatives, raising it to the government. And so, as much as I think there are very important divisions and distinctions between, to simplify it, big city Ontario and rural Ontario, there are also issues that affect us all equally. And that was actually, I think, what struck me most about Roma last week.
Very well said. Okay, let's get on to the mailbag here. We do enjoy getting your feedback. Here's the email address to get us at. It's onpolitics@tvo.org. And JMM, what have we got up this week?
We have a comment on my pronunciation from listener Michael Harrison, who wrote, on last week's podcast, JMM said XYZ instead of Z. He used the American pronunciation instead of the Canadian.
You know, I was debating. I was really debating. As soon as you said XYZ, my antennae went up and I was thinking, oh, man, now do I bust his chops on this right now or do I wait until after or what do I do? Because as soon as I heard it, I knew we would get some mail about it. And sure enough, we did. Now, I'm going to give you at least some kudos because at least you do say, when referring to the vice regal representative in the province of Ontario, you say lieutenant governor. I've never heard you say lieutenant governor. So I'm going to give you some props on that. But yeah, going forward, JMM, it's XYZ, not XYZ.
I think somebody tried to catch us on that, and we actually went back to the tape one time because somebody thought I had said lieutenant, and when we checked the tape, I had said lieutenant. So we actually have some added context from our producer, Matthew O'Mara, who looked this up. Zed is the older of the two pronunciations, first appearing in the 1400s. Z was first seen in 1670s, and it became prominent during the Revolutionary War as Americans were trying to distance themselves from anything British, including older ways of pronouncing, in this case, the final letter in the alphabet. Lots of other spelling differences and pronunciation changes between American and British English, of course. So really, you know, all I was trying to do, you can see, was just give us an excuse to impart a history lesson through my incorrect pronunciation.
In which case, history lesson successfully imparted. Well done.
Again, if you'd like to ask about content on the show, please email us at onpolitics@tvo.org. Now, on to issue one.
The Greenbelt land swap scandal has returned. Ryan Amato, who was the former chief of staff to then the Minister of Municipal Affairs and Housing, Steve Clark, sent an email from a private account to Patrick Sackville, who was Premier Doug Ford's principal secretary at the time. He's now the chief of staff. The email contained criteria for land to be removed from the Greenbelt. JMM, pick up the story if you would.
Anybody who spends any time in political journalism, you eventually learn that the dirty little secret about our freedom of information laws is that a lot of political staffers conduct government business more or less openly on their own personal emails that are not necessarily captured by servers and they are not operated by government employees. If a freedom of information request or a police investigation comes up and people are told to search their private inboxes, the law is still supposed to be able to capture those. And nevertheless, a lot of business happens on personal email inboxes. This the specifics of this issue, of this new email that has been revealed, are that it seems to indicate that the Premier's office was more directly involved in the selection of Greenbelt lands that were supposed to be carved out of the Greenbelt earlier than the Premier's office had claimed. It's not clear yet whether it sort of directly refutes the assertions that the Premier's office has been making up until now, but it certainly leads to more questions. Amato has resigned. Clark is still an MPP, but is no longer in cabinet. This could potentially cause more problems for the Premier. But I think the bigger point is just once again, and frankly, people might be tired of hearing me say this, but I mean, the damage from the Greenbelt scandal just keeps coming. And at least when the Premier reversed himself last year, I think you could argue that maybe they had sort of put a Band-Aid on it or stopped the bleeding. And it just seems like, no, there are more revelations coming out. There may be yet more. David Moskrop, one of our regular contributors at TVO.org, wrote a column for our website about what these repeated breaches of trust do to the provincial government's reputation. Probably will not shock anybody who knows David's writing that he was praising the government in that instance. He writes that good processes exist to prevent exactly these kinds of scandals from taking place, right? There's a reason why we have a civil service that is supposed to be part of the policymaking process, and clearly just was not part of this procedure. The Auditor General and Integrity Commissioner have already written reports about the Greenbelt scandal, and the government is following many of the recommendations laid out by the Auditor General. The one that they sort of dragged their feet on and insisted they were not going to follow was reversing the land swap entirely. Of course, they did eventually follow that one as well.
Let me pick up on the notion of checks and balances in our system to make sure that ministers or advisors to ministers or the premier, for that matter, aren't just out there freelancing, but there actually is some method to the madness. So, I mean, I, among many others, have asked some of the following questions. Where was the secretary to the cabinet in all of this? There's an oversight role to be performed there. Where was the deputy minister of municipal affairs and housing in all of this? Where was that oversight role? Those are two high-ranking civil servants whose job would be to scrutinize exactly these kinds of goings-on. Now, just some speculation here, but maybe they did weigh in, and maybe they were overruled by, let's just call them, people with more authority than them, or maybe they did not weigh in which case that's a problem of a different kind. Maybe a little clarification of who did what would be very helpful to better understanding how the Premier's decision to break his promise and allow development in the Greenbelt could have happened. And as we try to understand whether this story is essentially done, because the Premier, after all, has reversed himself and says there will be no development in the Greenbelt after all, it is worth remembering the following. And JMM, you touched on this. J. David Wake, the Integrity Commissioner, will be reviewing this issue. There's no timeline for when we'll receive a report from his office, but it's coming. The RCMP is still doing a probe of this matter. That's ongoing. So this issue seems to be far from gone from the headlines. And I guess I'll throw a question your way. John Michael, what ultimately do you think these two remaining investigations are designed to accomplish?
Well, the RCMP investigation is going to determine whether there's any actual criminal liability for any of the individuals, either Amato or former Minister Clark or potentially even Premier Ford himself. We don't know the full extent of the possible breaches of law here because new facts keep being uncovered. One law that has been mentioned a few times is breach of trust. This is the same crime that was alleged against two aides to former Premier Dalton McGuinty, although those charges were dropped in the process of their trial. You know, I think the other issue that you want to, that people should sort of get their head around early is that there is a broad sort of legal principle that governments are allowed to set and change policy, and there is going to be a threshold that any kind of prosecution has to clear where they are going to have to be able to demonstrate that this was much more than just a change in policy, the kind of which that a government should have a very broad scope to make or to change. But it is entirely possible that the RCMP could come away from this saying there is simply not enough evidence to support a prosecution, or we could see it move forward. We don't know yet. The other investigation you mentioned from the Integrity Commissioner is a different matter. Wake has no power to make a determination of criminal guilt, but he can find whether there was a breach of what's called the Members Integrity Act. That's a provincial law that is supposed to govern the behavior of MPPs. And the Integrity Commissioner can recommend possible sanctions up to and including expelling an MPP from the legislature. However, he has no power to impose those penalties himself. He can only leave the decision to the legislature itself. But as we've already seen in this scandal, the power to make findings of fact, like Wake did with a previous report about then-Minister Clark, and like the Auditor General has released her report as well, the ability to make findings of fact, to write and publish a report laying out the details of someone's conduct, these can be extremely damaging to the government. So we will see how this continues to evolve.
We sure will. In the meantime, on to issue two. Ontario's post-secondary system is in the middle of arguably one of its most chaotic moments in decades. Last week, the province announced a moratorium on partnerships between public and private colleges that, in response to a new federal regulation putting a two-year cap on the number of international students allowed to study in Canada. Mark Miller is the Minister of Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship of Canada. He says our system is out of control. But Ontario's post-secondary institutions are calling this a rushed, financially disastrous decision for them. So, John Michael, let's start to unpack this.
Okay, so for a bit of context here, in 2023, there were 900,000 international students studying in Canada, and the majority of them, 51%, were in Ontario. These students come to Canadian colleges and universities looking to study and get degrees that will lead to work here or back home. Post-secondary schools, both public and private, make a lot of money off of these students because international tuition is not regulated tightly the way domestic tuition is in Ontario. Ontario has the highest fees in all of Canada, charging an average of $46,000 a year for an undergraduate degree for a foreign student. The greatest growth in international students has been seen in career colleges, and those are part of Ontario's moratorium on public-private college partnerships.
Right. Let's do some more background here. Last year, there was a story about fake admission letters being given to students from India. Most were under the impression that they had the genuine article, and then they were faced with deportation. So this cap is hoping to cut down on those types of incidents from, let's call them, bad actors in the system. If we dive a little deeper, why is this happening to these students?
So while I think a lot of our listeners are going to be pretty familiar with, the largest universities in Ontario, your University of Toronto, your Queen's University, those are not primarily the institutions that are driving this boom in international students. We're seeing the growth is happening in the largest numbers at small private colleges, sometimes in partnership with larger universities, but they are being accused of really taking advantage of international students, given just how much money can be made from them. Students sometimes will enter into a college only to realize that there's not really the work or the path to easy citizenship that they were promised back home. Part of Ontario's moratorium is intended to bring stronger oversight on these private career colleges in particular. Over the last decade, the number of students at these colleges increased 12-fold. Another announced change from the federal government and this cap on foreign students is that they will no longer be giving out the work permits that were accompanying the student visas. This will do a few different things, but it could plausibly give students pause about whether they want to study in Canada at all if employment after their education is their goal.
In which case, what do we think is going to happen next?
Since 2023, there's been a verification process that requires universities to confirm admissions letters with Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship Canada. Now Canada is asking for an additional attestation letter from the province, but no province other than Quebec has that system in place yet. Another change from the feds is a cap on student visas that will no longer be giving out work permits. This was a part of a policy designed to make it easier for students to get Canadian work experience while they were here, so that you could go, in theory, go from studying in Canada to then applying for a job once you had your degree, and you could say that you had Canadian work experience. They are now limiting that. This will do a number of things, but one of the things it will do is make it less attractive to come to Canada because there won't be that automatic, easy pathway into the Canadian labor market.
Let's take a look at this story from another angle as well, because some believe that this cap on students might actually have some positive ramifications. For example, if there are fewer foreign students coming here, presumably there will be less of an impact on the number of houses you need or accommodation that you need for these kinds of folks. Well, let's get into that. Presumably, this will reduce demand for accommodation among these foreign students, and therefore, who knows, maybe ease up the housing crisis somewhat?
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. You know, you just look around, you can see how fierce the competition for housing in southern Ontario is right now. We have seen very pronounced effects. Every August, September, you see huge jumps in rent in university and college towns around the province. So I want to be careful about how we talk about this, because I don't think anybody here wants to blame these students for their situation. But we just We don't have enough houses to meet the demand that we have. Universities do have options for housing international students on their own premises, including on-campus residences. But those are expensive and in short supply, though. As we walked into our recording studio today, the federal government has announced new measures to improve the financing and make more money available for student housing programs. Students could, of course, look elsewhere. They can look to the private market for rentals, and they might find affordable housing. But everything we hear is that people are having 2 to 3 people sleeping in a room, landlords asking for large upfront payments because they know they can get it. In some cases, of course, accommodations lacking basic safety features, in some cases not even having smoke detectors, really nightmarish accounts of what I think you could fairly call exploitation of these international students. Ontario is now going to require post-secondary institutions to have a housing guarantee to ensure that the students that they admit actually have housing available to them. We will see if that makes a difference.
Well, let's do what Woodward and Bernstein always suggested back in the day, 50 years ago, when they were covering Watergate, and that is follow the money. Okay, we're going to follow the money here. We know that if you reduce the number of foreign students coming into Ontario post-secondary institutions, that's going to mean less revenue for these post-secondary institutions because these inflated tuitions are no longer going to be paid. The Ontario colleges and universities have said they need the government to invest more money in them to help wean them off from their over-reliance on foreign-born students. So take us down that road. What are they hoping for?
Well, unsurprisingly, they are asking for the provincial government to increase the flow of money to the post-secondary sector to boost the grants and to lift the tuitions they are allowed to charge. People may remember that in 2019, the provincial government froze tuitions and, in fact, imposed a 10% cut on domestic tuitions. The post-secondary sector says that needs to be undone. You need to unfreeze the tuitions, and in particular, you need to reverse that 10% cut. Global News has reported that the government of Ontario knew about the sector's over-reliance on international students, but instead of boosting the domestic tuition, they were, in fact, happy to accept this wave of international students and were working on ways to reduce barriers for international students and retain them after graduation, which, you know, in isolation, that's a totally sort of defensible policy. It just seems to have kind of run off the rails a little bit here in Ontario. In 2021 to 22, international students provided almost $3 billion in funding to schools. In 2022, publicly funded colleges were posting record surpluses due to international students, including from India, coming to their schools. Funding from international sources, it can be erratic or temperamental, if you want to use that word. I mean, we can talk about Canada's relationship with India, Canada's relationship with China. These are countries that you can never really rely on the constant outflow of people and money. You know, just turn your mind back to the dispute between Canada and China over Meng Wanzhou, the CFO of Huawei, who was detained in Canada about the that was about being extradited to the U.S. But like that was a months-long affair that threw a monkey wrench into our relations with China. Those kinds of issues keep cropping up. And frankly, if it wasn't going to be this change in national policy that was going to cause the crisis for Ontario's post-secondary sector, there was always the possibility of something else coming up.
Well, I can give you another example of that closer to home here in the province of Ontario as well. Back in the day when I was chancellor at Laurentian University, the Deputy Prime Minister of Canada said some very tough things, very critical things about Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia then turned around and canceled all of the visas from their students, which they needed in order to study at Laurentian University in Sudbury, Ontario. Well, the concomitant loss of income to Laurentian was so significant that it was one of the many things that contributed to that university filing for bankruptcy years later. So, yeah, this can be a very big deal, both financially, in terms of morality for the students, in so many different ways. And obviously, we'll continue to keep an eye on it and come back to it as needs be. In the meantime, on to issue 3. Progressive Conservative MPP Parm Gill has resigned from his position as the Minister of Red Tape Reduction in the Ford government to run federally for Pierre Poilievre's Conservative Party of Canada. Gill had represented Milton since winning the seat in 2018, but had once been an MP for Stephen Harper federally. So in some respects, everything old is new again. As we often do, let's do a deeper dive on this story because there are many subplots to it. JMM, where do you want to begin?
I would like to flag some reporting done by Politics Today that said that the federal Conservative Party is being very selective about which Ontario MPPs might want to run federally. You know, it's no secret that, you know, I think federal politics is just a bigger, more prominent job. And if you're an ambitious politician, not terribly surprising that a provincial politician might cast their eyes towards Ottawa. But the federal party is not simply throwing open the doors and saying, you know, come one, come all. They want to ensure what a federal conservative source called the stench of corruption doesn't follow any of them to the polls. This, of course, goes back to the Greenbelt land deal that continues to dog the government. Few MPPs have been considered, let's say, good enough to run federally. They include Parm Gill, clearly, but also it seems that Transportation Minister Pravmeet Sarkaria and Long-Term Care Minister Stan Cho also seemingly are getting passing marks from their federal colleagues. You know, let's just pull back for a second and say that, you know, this is only the most recent minister that Premier Ford has lost in the last 6 months or so. Khalid Rashid and Steve Clark both resigned due to their involvement with the Greenbelt fiasco. And then Monty McNaughton found a job in the private sector and also left politics. The Progressive Conservative Party did just announce late last week that they have found a candidate to run in McNaughton's old riding. So I suspect we might see a by-election there sooner rather than later. But, you know, just another hit to the provincial Progressive Conservative Party.
Right. Now, some people may be asking, why would the federal conservatives not want some of the higher profile or even more medium profile members of the Ford government to run for them? And the answer is because despite both being under a, I guess, a broadly spoken conservative banner, Doug Ford and Pierre Poilievre are not allies. Ford has always prohibited his MPPs from campaigning for federal candidates in previous federal elections. And we now know what some officials in the federal party think of the provincial MPPs, that comment about the stench of corruption. That's a tough line. Now, this latest resignation sets the stage for a by-election for the riding of Milton. Milton is not far from Mississauga, so some people have been wondering about whether the new Liberal leader, Bonnie Crombie, might contest the by-election there. I am hearing that there is, of course, a vigorous debate in the leader's office about that, and that the answer more than likely at the end of the day will be no. Even though the Tories only won it by 4 points back in 2022, Crombie probably will not, almost certainly will not, vie for that seat. Why do you think, JMM?
Well, there's a few things. Milton is, I guess, relatively close in the sense that it's like broadly the Western GTA. But it's not a slam dunk that Crombie would win if she ran there. Milton is not Mississauga. It's not even Peel Region. Even if she did win, then she's got the problem of, well, that's her job now. And she'd be expected to show up in the House and there are arguments that she doesn't actually want or need to be there. You know, we've heard this a few times since she won, that it frankly is more productive for her to be traveling the province, getting her name out there, getting her face out there, you know, finding more candidates, raising more money. There's a lot more to running a political party than showing up at the legislature, as important as you and I both believe the legislature to be.
Now, one of the things that you always hear whenever somebody leaves early, you often hear the suggestion made by the opposition that, what's the expression? The rats are starting to leave the sinking ship. In this case, what do you think about those allegations?
I mean, you know, it's always a possibility, or it's got that patina of plausibility. But, you know, let's assess it critically. You know, Gill does have that federal history. He doesn't exactly have the most senior job in cabinet. The Minister for Red Tape Reduction is not one of the power ministries, you would say. So, you know, he could be angling for a higher profile job if Pierre Poilievre does indeed become the next prime minister. But I think it's also fair to say that some of his colleagues are probably not thrilled with him right now. We've said this before on the podcast. Politics is a team sport. And you even saw this when Steve Clark left, that there were certainly reports that people were quite upset with the manner of his departure. They felt that it was leaving the premier to hold the bag, if I could put it that way. And so even just the appearance that Gill is getting out while the getting's good is potentially damaging to his colleagues who are sticking around and still have a government to run, at least until the next election in 2026.
Yeah, let me raise another angle on this story as well. And this one actually follows up on a question we got from a listener a few weeks ago. We were asked, you may remember, whether party nominations are genuine exercises in democracy or is basically the fix in. And my answer at the time was, well, it's both. Sometimes there are genuine open contests for the right to represent a political party in a particular riding. And, you know, a number of candidates step forward and they try to sign up members and then they try to win a convention. Well, this was not one of those incidents, obviously. The Federal Conservative Party wanted Parm Gill as its candidate. Parm Gill wanted to be the candidate. Once they knew that that matchmaking was going to be successful, the party announced that he would run for the nomination, and they then announced that they would change the party rules, which require 14 days notice if any others want to run for the nomination before they close the door on nominations. They changed the rule, and then they said, nominations are closed right now. Now, is any of that democratic? Not particularly, since conservative voters in Milton are certainly being deprived of a choice of candidates in their nominating convention. But this is a great example of how, if parties want to change the rules to suit their leaders' interests, they can certainly do so. It's called putting your thumb on a scale for a candidate. And there's frankly not a darn thing anyone can do about it.
We have seen in the past some jilted candidates. They try suing in court for depriving them of their rights to run in a fair and open competition. In general, the courts have sided with parties in the past, saying that they are essentially private clubs and they can do what they want. Very, very rarely you get a case where a party has acted so egregiously that they've actually violated their own internal bylaws. But even there, yeah, courts have generally given parties very wide leeway to do what they want. So if there were others who were looking to run for the Conservative nomination in Milton, very sorry, but you are very likely out of luck. And now, on to your column, my column.
Time now for our regular feature, Your Column, My Column, in which JMM and I reminisce about columns that we wrote for our website, tvo.org, over the past week. JMM, let me tee you up and have you start by telling us what you've got up your sleeve.
I wrote about an interesting report by the C.D. Howe Institute, which looked at whether there will actually be enough electric vehicles made or able to be imported in Canada by 2035 to meet the target the national government has set of basically being 100% electric by that year. This report found that there will not be sufficient production of electric vehicles to meet that target. Now, the report itself is certainly open to criticism. What was fun about this story was that for relatively technical, one might even say, kind of dry material for, you know, matters of auto regulation, some people gave me some spicy quotes for that one, Steve. I would encourage our readers to go read it because it's rare for the world of white papers and policy wonks to be. It was not quite pistols at dawn, but the two people I spoke with kind of got into it a little bit. They mixed it up, and that was fun. What about you, Steve?
Well, I did a piece for the website last week on a real larger-than-life character by the name of Rocco Rossi. And that name may ring some bells with some of our listeners because he did run in the provincial election, I guess a few elections ago, and he also ran for mayor of Toronto once upon a time as well. That was the year that Rob Ford won, so back in 2010. Mr. Rossi has just come to the end of his 6-year tenure as the head of the Ontario Chamber of Commerce, one of obviously the most important special interest groups in the province of Ontario. And given that he's about to turn 62 this week, I guess a lot of people have been asking him, Rocco, are you retiring? And he assures everybody he is not retiring, he is rewiring, which is a new expression I suspect we're going to hear more of in the years ahead. Rocco Rossi had a huge role to play when COVID first hit to make sure that businesses in particular were protected from the ravages of COVID-19. So he certainly had numerous meetings with government about how the province could help backstop temporarily businesses in the province so that they didn't go under during the worst of COVID. Now that he has left his time at the Chamber of Commerce, he's actually, as we speak, over in Spain, where he is walking the 1,000-kilometer-long Camino de Santiago, which is this, of course, internationally recognized amazing biosphere that a lot of people walk from time to time. This is the 18th time that he will be walking this thing. So he has frequently gone back to Spain in order to clear his head and sort of figure out what his next mission in life will be. As we suggested, Rocco's larger than life. He's 6'3" tall. He's a big presence. He's got a big smile. He's got a big booming voice. So I don't know what his next mission is going to be when he returns, but I can predict it's going to be big.
You know, I first met Rocco covering that 2010 election, and he was on the ballot in the end. He dropped out of the race right before voting day, but his name was still on the ballot. So there were a handful of votes for him. That was such a wild race to cover, and for you know, everybody gets into a race thinking obviously that they've got a shot, and in the end, for whatever reason, you know, people like the late mayor Rob Ford and George Smitherman, they ended up sort of sucking up a lot of the oxygen, and Rocco really just did not. He tried to make some big announcements, tried to put some big ideas into the race. You know, ended up not making it, but he's obviously stayed in public life. I kind of suspect, as you say, we have not heard the last of Rocco Rossi.
Yeah, in fact, he and I had a very candid conversation about many of the very serious politically strategic mistakes he made in that mayoral campaign, along with a very tough provincial campaign where he switched parties and ran. He was a Liberal his whole life, and then he ran for the Conservatives for Tim Hudak in one of the prior elections. And, he's very candid at this stage of his life about mistakes he made and why he didn't win. So anyway, go to our website, tvo.org, and have a look at both of those columns if you would, because it'll make JMM and I feel better, if nothing else. That is the On Poly podcast for this January 30th, 2024. Remember to listen to the very end of our podcast to find out what embarrassing comments JMM or I made before we actually started recording this thing.
You can follow our show on Apple Podcasts so that you get notified each time a new episode is available. And if you already follow our show, help a friend follow it too.
Any feedback you have, we're happy to hear it. Good, bad, or indifferent. Write us an email at onpolitics@tvo.org.
This week's episode was produced and edited by Matthew O'Mara. Our managing editor is Katie O'Connor.
Production support from Christine Gardner and Jonathan Halliwell. Until next Tuesday, bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everyone. I actually biked to 2180 today.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah.
And do you have a police escort, of course, when you drive to work?
Right up until the moment I pull into the parking garage, and then they peel off to go take care of more important matters.
What could be more important than getting you to the studio for this podcast?
That's what I say.